Welcome back. My name is Joel Thiel.
My name is Ian McMillan.
And today we are here with Brent Pinkel. Welcome.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate this. This is fun.
Yeah. We're very excited to get into this interview. We have a lot of great stuff to cover. Ian, you want to kick us off?
Yeah, I guess first order of business is who are you?
Well, I am Brent Pinkel. I am lecturer of rhetoric here at New St. Andrews. And this is my first year as lecturer of rhetoric. Last year, I was a reader in history here, but before coming here, I was all sorts of titles at a college in China where I taught for, and I'm in still working there from the States, but I taught there for a number of years, and that's who I am.
And what initially got you interested in rhetoric?
I was, from a young age, I was always interested in arguing. I would say things to my parents like, I'm not arguing, I'm debating. You know, I'm not talking back. We're just debating here. So I was always interested in arguing and in words. But I was a public school kid. So I didn't grow up with a classical education, and so my love of language and of persuasion just came out in some more organic ways that weren't especially cultivated in school very well. What really got me interested, where my abilities kind of blossomed and my interests grew, was actually when I went to college. So I went to Kansas State University, and it was there where I really began following Jesus seriously. And the first, I shouldn't say the first preacher. I went to a local church there, but I very quickly was introduced to John Piper. And I was so caught up in Piper has such a way with words. Even now, having reflected on his preaching and seen many more preachers, I would say he's the best preacher in our generation, at least Western preacher that we know of. Of course, I'm sure there's great preachers that are don't get the publicity that he does. But he's a phenomenal preacher in terms of his ability to expound the word clearly and compellingly. And of course, if you know anything, if you've read much of him, I mean, he's written an entire book on the power of words and language. And he writes poetry. And so he would, listening to his preaching, I would listen to a sermon of his probably every day for my first year of following Christ. Mm. And that, I mean, besides just him make me fall in love with Christ, I fell in love with words to a degree that I hadn't really before. So that was the beginning of things. But again, I was public school. We didn't have anything like rhetoric, and we can come back to this later of how I ended up in China. But went to China for a while, and eventually ended up at New St. Andrews. And my first exposure to classical rhetoric was during grad school here at New St. Andrews. And I took you guys have already interviewed Dr. Schlecht. Mm-hmm. So Dr. Schlecht had a couple electives while I was here. One was just a classical rhetoric elective, and another was forensic oratory, I think was the name of the class. It was basically mock trial. And that's where I was exposed to classical rhetoric, Quintilian, you know, Aristotle, Cicero, and all of these things I intuited and felt were suddenly, you know, expounded in very powerful and articulate ways that made sense to me. And so that was the beginning. That was really the, I have to credit Dr. Schlecht with getting me really interested in classical rhetoric. Of course, nice. He's a rhetoric guy. He was mock trial coach at Logos School here for many years. Mm-hmm. Went back to China and started teaching rhetoric there, and things just grew. So that's a little bit about how things got started. Yeah. We can flesh that out a little bit more here, but
yeah. I'm actually really interested. There's a lot there, but I think I want to go first to kind of your just Christian testimony and how you came to know Christ. Could you expand upon that a little bit?
Yeah. So yeah. I grew up in a Catholic home. Okay. Very loving parents, and we would go to church every week. I was confirmed. I was more or less a faithful Catholic. Mm-hmm. But my understanding of the gospel was very works-based. Mm-hmm. Do good, and if you do enough good, you go to heaven. And I didn't know, you asked me what the gospel is, or why did Jesus die? I didn't really know. I knew he died, and you're supposed to believe that he died on a cross. That was the case all throughout my childhood, through high school. And then I went to college and got involved in a campus ministry in Navigators. And I started reading the Bible for myself and joined a Bible study. And my world was turned upside down. I encountered Christ in the scriptures. And of course, I had some really great men in my life, pastors in my life who were teaching the scriptures and living it out and walking me through my questions. But I was just captivated by the glory of Christ. And this, I mentioned John Piper earlier. Mm. And man, I mean, you really have to have a heart of stone to not be moved by Piper. Just, I couldn't stop thinking about the glory of God and seeing that, everywhere I looked. That was the beginning. And then things escalated, if you will, when I started attending. So my church hosted a class called Perspectives on the World Christian Movement. And this is a class that I think it's still around. I'm not sure. But different churches around the country can host this class, and each week they invite it's a missions class basically. Okay. And they invite a missionary from the field so the missionaries will come off the field for a little bit of time and travel around and to these different classes and give talks. And I was just enamored with these missionary stories of life on the field in these hard places. And there was people in remote tribes of Papua New Guinea, telling all these stories about casting out demons from it was just I mean, I was so just captivated by these stories. Yeah. And for missionaries from the Middle East, and I mean, I remember one guy, he told this story about a Muslim who converted, and the local community, the question was this young man asked the missionary, can you baptize me? And then the question was, should it be a public baptism or a private baptism? And the missionary said, well, what would you like? And he said, I think Christ is calling me for public baptism, but my family and the community, the buzz is if I do this, I'm going to get killed, which means if you baptize me, you're going to get killed as well. And so the missionary is just talking about what went through his mind. Like, okay, are we going to do this or not? And yeah. I mean, these are the kinds of stories I was hearing week after week. Mm. And, but then there was a China guy who came and told some really exciting stories. And I was early on, this was my sophomore year in college when I went to the first year of this, and every year after I'd go back and listen to more missionaries. But, where was he going? So, the, forgot where I was going to go with this, but the China missions guy really got me interested in serving in China, but I also wanted to serve Muslims. The Muslim guy got me interested in Muslims, and I had some Chinese friends. I was studying Chinese for on the side for my degree, just because I thought it was interesting and different. So I started making Chinese friends through that, and eventually I learned again through this class that so China's not all the same. Like, Chinese people aren't all the same. Can you believe it? And in a giant country like that, not Chinese people aren't all the same. There's actually minority groups that. You've heard stories during the Cultural Revolution and this explosion of this sort of revival of Christianity. Mm-hmm. And so there's this impression that, there's just Christians and churches everywhere. But that's largely true for the Han Chinese, which are the most common people group in China. But there's all these other minority groups, and there are some Muslim minority groups. And that's when I learned about these Muslim minority groups, then I became just really interested, and I had a burden to bring the gospel to them because they didn't have churches. They, for all intents and purposes, were unreached, and so that was. I had been a Christian, a practicing Christian for a year, and then I'm already starting to think I these people don't know this Christ, and that's wrong, and he deserves the glory, he deserves to be praised, and we got to do something about this. And so early on I had this desire to want to bring the gospel to China, and so that was what initially brought me to China.
And what was your experience like moving to that culture? Like, what were some of the challenges that you encountered?
Oh, that's a big question. Yeah, what were the challenges you encountered? So, the challenges were different. So, I studied first in Northeast China. So, Muslims are in Western China. I first went to Northeast China to learn Chinese, Mandarin, and that was a little bit. It was a little bit easier. The Han Chinese are just easier. They're a little bit more like me, but I mean, Chinese culture is still very, very different from Western culture. So that was a little bit easier when you move west to Western China and you start living in this sort of Muslim, this Muslim culture, things get a little bit more difficult. I think the challenge for anybody that's wanting to do mission work is learning the language.
Yeah.
And I had studied 3 years of Chinese at public university in Kansas. And when I went to China, like, I couldn't have a conversation with a Chinese person. Basically, the approach of my Chinese class was like, let's just have a good time, guys. Okay. And not like NSA. NSA like actually cares that you learn the languages that you study and you're able to speak them. Yeah. That wasn't really the case for us. It was, let's play some fun Chinese games, make some Chinese friends, and we'll just have a good time. Nobody was really serious about studying it. And if you go to China, so when I went to China, I studied full-time Chinese for 2 years, and there were most of the foreigners there were there to have a good time.
Okay.
And of course, you've got Chinese students who want to befriend you to learn English. And so there's all this pressure just to speak English all the time. And so I had to set some boundaries for myself. I would not befriend Chinese people who wanted to learn English. Just politely avoid them. And I would avoid hanging around foreigners so that I would be forced to speak Chinese. And that was actually, on the whole, I think that was a good decision. I made a lot of progress very quickly. God blessed it. I started leading, I started leading Bible studies in Chinese. And when you have a motivation to learn a language, you make a lot more progress than when you just study for its own sake. So that was the first big challenge was just language. Did you have
Well, was that particularly when it came to evangelism, was there any, you know, other than language, kind of cultural barriers and just conveying like gospel ideas?
So we tend to think of Chinese as Buddhist. And actually that's a minority of Chinese. Most Chinese, Han Chinese are atheist. And so in that regard, I mean, that's more and more so the case here. Although I suppose now there's kind of this new age spiritualism that's becoming popular. But the challenge, that was a big challenge. It's, I mean, the Communist Party is, and public education pushes this whole, the whole atheist, I mean, very strongly the, just emphasize atheism's the way and everything else is rubbish. And so that was first the, just the, overcoming the materialism and atheism, some of those hurdles, which I had encountered that a lot with my American friends back home. So that wasn't too hard. And it was, I would say with Han Chinese, I actually, it wasn't, sharing the gospel with them wasn't too much different from sharing the gospel with Americans. I think China is an honor shame culture. And so that changes the dynamics of things. And so, you know, it's common here in the US, some evangelism methods will do the kind of the law, like, you know, your guilt, the law metaphors, you're guilty under the law. Here's God's law. You've broken the law. And, you know, Jesus fulfilled the law and, you know, the judge has deemed you, you know, innocent or, you know, the punishment was taken for you. Like these metaphors, and of course they're biblical, but I think they maybe strike the Chinese conscience not as heavily as some of the more honor shame motifs in the New Testament. The prodigal son, right? That's not a law based story. It's the gospel is presented in an honor shame way. You know, you've got the son who dishonors the father by, you know, taking the inheritance and leaving. He's too ashamed to go home. And then the father, you know, comes out running to him and welcomes him back. Those kinds of, so learning how to tell the gospel, share the gospel with more of those motives really, really helped. But, you know, when I moved to Western China to start working with Chinese Muslims, that was quite different and in many ways more difficult. But I got along really well with Chinese, and one of the reasons I love China so much, the people were just really great to me. There's a word in Chinese, 热情, just warm feelings is direct translation, but they just treat you with, you know, warm feelings. And and so I got along really well with them, and I still have a great fondness for Chinese people. But the Lord's brought me back here for now anyway. We'll see what the future holds.
And while there, you helped set up a classical Christian school there. How long was that after you moved over that you started working?
I didn't actually go over there with the goal of doing that. I went over there first with the goal of church planting among these Chinese Muslims. Like that was the goal.
And was that with any particular denomination, or was that kind of through missions organization?
I worked with some, it wasn't denomination, it was more like parachurch organizations, but I worked with a few different parachurch organizations. I was Baptist for a long time. I'm Presbyterian now, but at the time I was Baptist, working with mostly Baptists. And I love my Baptist brothers and sisters, and I think they have the best preachers. So I will occasionally go to a Baptist church just to fellowship with my brethren and enjoy the preaching. But So I went to China first to do church planning. And then as I learned which gifts I had, I discovered I'm more gifted to teach than to pastor per se. And so that's when I started shifting to Christian education and discovered classical Christian education. And so I actually discovered classical Christian education in China through Pastor Wilson's blog.
Awesome.
And it was John Piper who introduced me to Pastor Wilson. Pastor Wilson preached at one of their conferences on C.S. Lewis. And I noticed Pastor Wilson had a way with words. Mm-hmm. And that really drew me to him. And I found his blog. And if you've read his blog, he has a way with words. And so he introduced me to classical Christian education and just really... all the pieces. I had felt a lot of these goals of classical Christian education. I had felt them intuitively in various ways, but I'd never heard it articulated. I didn't know this was a thing. And when I discovered this, I thought, this is what I'm made for. This is it. And so I started looking in to see if is anybody in China doing this. I didn't want to leave China. I wanted to keep on. Helping to disciple these believers. And I couldn't find anything except this one Chinese church in central China. And so I emailed them. I just found this article written by an elder there who said they were wanting to start this classical Christian school, this K-12 school. And so I flew down there on my own dime just to see what they were doing, to talk with them, and discovered they were wanting to start a college modeled off of NSA, loosely modeled off of NSA. And I thought, I've got to work with you guys. We got to do that. I would love to help out. And so that was then that I decided, well, I'm going to go to NSA. We'll get my master's, see how this works. And then I'll come back and help you guys start this college. And so that's how I got into classical Christian education. That's how that college started.
And you still teach online for that college?
Yes. So I took a break this first year teaching rhetoric here, just so I can focus on getting the course sort of. I had to put in a lot of work this year just to put my own spin on the course. And so now that I've got those things laid, I'm lined up to go back to teaching online. So I should mention, I came back to the United States at the end of 2018. I was forcefully kicked out of the country. When I came back here, I did keep teaching online full time for them. And then eventually NSA asked me to work here. So I'll be, starting next year, I'll be teaching again for them, but I'll still be here at NSA as well.
Yeah. Could you elaborate on getting kicked out a little bit? Like what's the state of kind of just Christianity in China generally? Is it generally frowned upon? What's kind of the attitude towards it there?
Yeah. So the Communist Party, by law, they recognize Christianity and it's legal to be a Christian and to worship as a Christian, but you must worship in state-approved churches. Mm-hmm. And you can imagine what that means. So the CCP forces the state-approved churches, the preaching must align with the communist values. And if you're not in line, then they, force you to change or shut you down.
Yeah.
And so because of that, most Chinese, I would say, maybe 2/3 of Chinese Christians go to churches that aren't state approved. Sometimes these are called house churches because originally, after the during Cultural Revolution, they were meeting in houses, and now some of these have become meeting in houses. They've become so large, but for many years, the Communist Party tolerated these. They didn't really, they weren't legal per se, but they didn't really care as long as you weren't plotting to overthrow the government.
Yeah.
but then Xi Jinping came to power and really locked, or I can't think of the word now, but the passed some new policies that basically forced these house churches, either you register with the government, become one of these three self churches is what they call them, or we shut you down. And so there was this new wave of persecution, where especially they started with the most influential house churches. And I was with one of those. The whole time I was there, every week, two police officers would come to the church and film, record the sermon, record the audience. And I was the only foreigner that would go there every week. So the, I think all of the mission organizations that have people working in China, all the ones that I encountered anyway, required their missionaries to not attend Chinese churches for the sake of for your own safety and for the sake of the church, not getting them in trouble. And that bothered me. And so I would work with groups that were with these organizations, but I wouldn't join the organization so that I could go with these churches, because I think it's important for the missionaries who are helping these churches to be a part of their community, to be worshiping with them. And of course we were starting a school, and so all my students were going to this church, and I wanted to worship them and to understand. So I would go there, and I got their blessing, and they welcomed me, and I'm really glad I did. But of course you go every week with the police video recording you, wondering how long is this going to last?
Yeah.
And I lasted longer than I expected, but then, shortly before they raided the church, eventually they raided the church, closed the whole thing down, imprisoned the pastors. And, many of my students were arrested, sent to a re-education center. And, about a month before they did all that, they got rid of me presumably so that the U.S. government wouldn't get involved. hearing about the imprisoning of missionary in China, that doesn't sound good in the news. So they kicked me. They basically one day just came and sent a group of police officers into church. It was an interesting experience, because usually there was these two police officers that would come, and we had made this plan with the Chinese with the pastor that, if the church is being raided while I'm there, I should try to escape if I can. And they asked me, to sit near a door. And so the two police officers come in and then walk right down the aisle past me, and then a third.
Was this during a service?
This is during a service. Okay. And then a fourth, and then a fifth, and then a sixth, and then a seventh. And then, all right, this is different.
Yeah.
And so I thought I was being sly. When the eighth one went, and there was no more coming, and they were still walking to sit down in the back, I thought, I'm just going to sneak out here. They're not going to find me. I mean, they didn't seem to look at me when they walked, when they walked by, and I'm foolish for thinking I don't blend in very well, but so I sneak out, and then, as soon as I sneak out the door, I hear them yelling, and all eight of them in the middle of the sermon run down the aisle yelling at me. Long story short, I ended up having to go and get interrogated, and that was an interesting experience too.
What sorts of things did they ask?
What did they ask? Yeah. Well, they were really curious about my involvement with the church and with the pastor. What are you doing here? And, it was really interesting, cause it dawned on me. I mean, I was prepared for this, that this was, I'm a little weird, maybe. I don't think this is weird. I think this is, I think most missionaries think about these kinds of things, but, you know, you look forward to, you read all them, like the martyr stories and if you listen to John Piper, come on, he's always like, don't waste your life. Like, you know, give your life for Christ. Like, what an honor to die for Christ and all this stuff. And so I was excited. I've always, you know, I'm still bummed I wasn't imprisoned, because I would love the prison experience and the prison testimony, you know, like what's it's so great. And
because it did seem like it was those stories that initially inspired you to go in the first place.
Yeah, and I mean, like, again, like, I had all these missionary stories that I'd heard all the time, and so what an honor to be like a part of this. So so I finally get to go to a Chinese like police station and interrogation room, and you know, is what's coming after that. You know, am I going to go to jail? And so I walk into the interrogation room, and it was this concrete, this small little concrete room, a little bit larger than this little room we have here. Just all concrete. And in the middle is a metal chair. It looks like an electric chair, just bolted to the ground, and it's got these shackles and this thing that goes over your waist, kind of like a baby's high chair. Like, it's got this thing that goes over your waist and then shackles you in.
Yeah. Wow.
And again, like, I had no idea how this was going to go, because you hear, you know, I've heard a lot of stories about people being tortured and stuff. And so the first thing I asked when I walk in there, I was like, are you going to sit down? Are you going to shackle me? And because I wanted the shackled experience, and they said no. And so I was like a little bit, well, I didn't ask them, can you shackle me just for kicks? But the police were really nice. As nice as they could be, I guess. But we had some interesting, besides, you know, me answering the questions, I started asking them questions, because I was really curious what it's like to be a Chinese police officer. You know, what do you think of America? And they had some interesting thoughts about that. One of them said he had just come back from visiting California, and seeing their criminal justice system, and seeing the police, what the police are like there. And he said, you know, man, it's so dangerous in America. There's people with guns all over the place, all these shootings all the time. China's safe. Like, we don't have this problem. He was kind of boasting about how great their police were. And I said, and I told him, you know what's safer than China? North Korea. and so anyway, we had this nice, this fun exchange. But what things really got heated up, though, after they interrogated me, the Religious Affairs Bureau people came. Wow. And they were like out of a movie. There was like one of the guys, an older guy, was like Two-Face from like Batman. Like, he had some like birthmark, and it was like, wow. And they were intense and yelled at, you know, it would yell at me like in the movies and all of that. But we had great, like, I realized I could ask them questions too, because I am really curious, like, what makes you tick, and why are you doing this, and why are you so worked up about Christians worshiping Jesus? And so started asking them, you know, are you a Christian? And one of the guys said, you know, his parents were Christians. And that was interesting. And so I got to have a conversation. Well, why don't you believe, are you an atheist? He was an atheist. Why don't you believe in God? And so I got to share the gospel, you know, with them. And so it was a really interesting experience. Yeah. And, but at the end of the day, you know, they kicked me out, and we'll see if, I don't know if I'll get a chance to go back. I hope I do, but the Lord opened up a door here for me at NSA, and I'm happy to teach students here, have some really great students.
Yeah. And going back to like your teaching in college there, and your discovery of the classical orators like Quintilian and Cicero, how did that kind of change your view of rhetoric? Undergraduate college,
right?
If it was your first experience at NSA, then it was probably a different looking rhetoric curriculum,
right? That's a great question. So rhetoric. Well, I should mention too, while I was at NSA in grad school, I did a project where I interviewed, well, I reviewed all of the main modern rhetoric textbooks on the market. And then I interviewed dozens of rhetoric teachers from across the country, high school rhetoric teachers, with the goal of getting a sense of the state of rhetoric education today. And so I as I started reading then the ancient texts like Quintilian and Cicero and Aristotle, I began to discover where we're neglecting the ancients and how we're missing some things. I think we have a lot of, in the, you know, the classical movement is still quite young. This, what we call the classic, I mean, that's even that word classical is the way we use it is it's a recent innovation. Mm-hmm. The ancients didn't say we're doing classical education here. That's a modern thing, but it's still young, and we're still trying to figure out how does this whole thing work, because we're trying to recover this tradition that we didn't preserve well. And so, and I think rhetoric is still has a lot of room to grow and recovering this tradition. And so one of the things that one of the convictions I had as I read, Quintilian, for example, is that rhetoric is an act. It's a simple idea, but we tend to think of rhetoric as a theory. It's just a theory. And if you master the theory, then you've mastered rhetoric. And it's often taught this way. You teach the students, you know, some rhetorical figures. Here's the figures, and can you identify them? And ethos, pathos, logos, what are they? And then, you know, you give the student a passage, and okay, where's the ethos? Where's the logos? You know, where's the pathos? And if they correctly identify it, oh, look, well, I'm a master rhetorician now. And that's not how the ancients understood rhetoric education. So Quintilian hopefully divides art. He has a section where he's talking about what is art, what kind of an art is rhetoric, and he says there's three kinds of arts. There are three theoretical arts, there are poetic arts, and practical arts. And theoretical arts, the goal of a theoretical art is to obtain knowledge. So we study it to get the information in your head. And that's the goal. So like philosophy or something, you understand the thing. Understanding is the goal. Poetic arts, the goal is to create an artifact, a physical artifact. So, you know, a sculpture, a poem, a building, that's a poetic art. And a practical art, the goal is an action. So it's to produce an action, like martial arts or something like that. And many, if not most today, think of rhetoric and teach rhetoric either as a theoretical art or as a poetic art. And Quintilian says, although rhetoric has aspects of both of those, it's primarily a practical art. It's an act, because the goal of rhetoric is to produce an act, that is a speech. And this dramatically affects how you teach it. So rhetoric should not be taught like a philosophy class where we're examining the theory and we're trying to memorize the theory of rhetoric. I mean, there is a theory to rhetoric. There are principles, but the goal isn't just memorize the principles and voila, you've mastered rhetoric. The goal is to be able to speak persuasively. And that's two very different things, to know how to speak and to be able to speak are two very different things. And so my conviction and what I strive to do here at NSA is to teach rhetoric as an act, as a, the ancients frequently use martial language, or athletics, athletic analogies to describe how to practice, rhetoric. And so rhetoric is, the way I approach it, it's a training regimen, and the main way that we cultivate this skill is through practice. It's through doing the acts, doing the exercises. And so the ancients would begin with the progymnasmata, preliminary exercises. You can hear gymnastics, gymnasmata. So it's, again, very athletic kind of language. And so these are a series of exercises that begin easy. They get harder as you go, and they introduce you to, different skills. They isolate different skills and you practice them individually. I can tell my students, if you want to learn, suppose you want to learn how to box, you've never boxed before, and you show up at the gym and you got the coach there, and you say, all right, I want to learn how to box. A good coach is not just going to throw you into the ring and say, all right, here's somebody, just go fight them. You start with some push-ups, right? And then you hit the punching bag, and you each of these little exercises isolates and hones a specific skill. And then once you've conditioned yourself, once you've practiced all of these different, moves and skills, then you put them all together in a complete training exercises, which the ancients called declamation. And so eventually we graduate to declamation, and that's the real battleground, if you will, in which we cultivate these skills. But I like to tell my students that I use an analogy of the Cheeto Man. We have the metaphorical Cheeto Man. And the Cheeto Man, here's the Cheeto Man. The Cheeto Man, overweight guy, a white t-shirt that's a little too small for him, sitting in his recliner, eating his Cheetos, and he loves watching MMA. Every night he sits back in his recliner, eats his Cheetos, and watches MMA, and analyzes every little thing that the fighters do. And he's yelling at the TV, "No, no, no! You should have moved this way, moved that way." And the joke, if you will, is he meets some guy and tells the guy, "Hey, I'm a martial artist," and he says, "Oh, really? Yeah, you're a martial artist. Like, well, where have you know?" He looks him up and down, with his Cheeto stained shirt. "Oh, martial artist, really? All right. When's the last time you fought?" "Oh, I've never fought. I've never fought. But I could tell you anything you want to know about martial arts, right? I can tell you how to kick. How to, when the guy goes this way, you should go that way. I can tell you everything." And of course, we understand how humorous that is, right? That doesn't make you a martial artist. The fact that you can identify what the guy should have done. Mm-hmm. What would make you a martial artist is, can you get into the ring and take the guy down yourself? Mm-hmm. Like, that's a martial artist. Mm-hmm. And yet many times we talk about rhetoric or rhetoricians like the Cheeto Man, right? Mm-hmm. Hey, I can identify ethos, pathos, logos, right? I can tell you what figure of speech this is. That doesn't make you a rhetorician. It doesn't make you an orator. You're a fine analyst, if you will. But being able to persuade somebody is a very different and more difficult skill than just being able to identify the theoretical mm-hmm. principles. And so Quintilian was huge in helping me to see this and model this for me. But of course, all the ancient rhetoricians understood this, and they talk about this, and so that's how I approach rhetoric here. So it's very focused on exercise and practice. We still have theory, also imitation. So imitation, theory, practice is kind of the trifecta that the ancients would stress. So we study examples of good rhetoric, but the main emphasis here is practice, 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 mm-hmm. and uh, And as the more students do this, the more progress they'll see. But it's a slow, you know, nobody learns, you know, nobody becomes Cicero in a day. And that makes some students get frustrated because of that. You know, hey, I've been, especially, you know, I've read Cicero, and I'm not any more persuasive. Like, what's the deal? It's not working. It's like, that's, yes. And in fact, Cicero begins his whole book by telling you, mm-hmm. if you don't practice, this is going to be useless to you. Mm-hmm. And so I stress that to the students, but they slowly discover, yeah, the more we do these exercises, I actually do become more persuasive. I actually am able to invent arguments, more arguments than I otherwise would have been able to, you know, and so it's fun to see them grow. But I would love to see rhetoric education and just classical circles graduate beyond just theory.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It looks like we're running a little bit low on time, but there's one thing that we have to talk about that I've been dying to talk to you about.
Okay.
Going back to China, you hosted a Chinese travel show.
Yes.
So please
tell
us about that.
What was your experience? How did you get involved in doing that?
So this was after I had decided to come to NSA. I needed money, and I was already teaching at a university there, public university there, to get money, but I needed more money. Mm-hmm. And I heard from a friend that the provincial TV station was wanting to film a travel show with a foreigner hosting, and kind of like an Anthony Bourdain kind of thing. Hmm. You travel around and experience Chinese culture from a foreigner's perspective. So I just called up the guy. I had previously had some experience in Chinese television. I was a finalist in this Chinese language competition, and they flew me to Beijing, and that's another story. I ended up on national TV dressed in a cowboy outfit that was about three sizes too small, playing bongo drums.
Is this still available on
this
the internet?
This is available in the deep recesses of the internet, and hopefully it stays hidden there.
Okay.
But I'd had some experience in Chinese television, and so that helped in my favor. And so they hired me to host the show, and so we would travel around different parts of the province, experiencing Chinese culture in all kinds of different ways. We would, you know, sometimes, you know, we'd have like a food show. We'd try different kinds of foods, or I would go behind the scenes of some China, you know, in the back kitchen of some, noodle restaurant, and they would teach me how to make noodles. Or we would go to a Chinese opera, and then I would go and backstage, and all the actors would, you know, teach me different things. I'd, you know, talk with the director of the orchestra, and he would show me how to direct. And we have an episode with a famous, you know, sculptor, and she would take me to her studio and teach me how to sculpt. But there was this different experiences like that. And that was a blast. And what was interesting was my Chinese wasn't very good at the time. And so that was part of the fun, was like, I would make these blunders in front of the camera. And then afterwards in the editing, they would make fun of me. They were like, you know, I don't know if you've seen Asian TV, but they have all these like cartoons that pop up on the screen, and they have these words, and they'll make fun of how I say things. And so that was, I was kind of the butt of the joke. I knew that I played into that a little bit. I'm hired to make a fool of myself. But it was a lot of fun. Yeah. There were some challenging experiences as a Christian these weren't Christians. Mm. And so they, you know, try and get you to force you to do things, and you would turn it down and make people mad. And, that was the, we probably filmed 20 some episodes. Mm. But I got my money, and it was because of all that I was able to come to NSA, and so very thankful for that experience.
And these are also publicly available, possibly.
Oh, they're on the deep recesses of the internet too. Nobody would know. Your audience doesn't need to watch those.
Well, Awesome. Right. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I wish we had
thank you guys.
A lot more time. But, yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.